Dear Nasties, before we start today's episode, we wanted to make two brief announcements about two very exciting new collaborations. The first one is with Castbox. Castbox is an online platform that helps promote podcasts to millions of listeners worldwide, which is pretty cool, right? And the also pretty cool thing for you is that Castbox is also an app, and you can use it to listen to all of your podcasts for free. You can, most importantly, use it to listen to our podcast for free. You know, listeners keep asking us what podcast app they should use to listen to us, and now we have an answer. Just use Castbox. It's pretty cool. And it's also available on iOS and Android, so go ahead and make that download. Secondly, we are now hosted by Blog Talk Radio. You may have noticed that there are no ads within our episode, and the reason for that is that the hosting service automatically inserts ads into our episodes. We are trying to keep those as few, and we are trying to keep them in line with our basic values, and we are hoping that you're not too bothered by it. You know, making a podcast takes a lot of time, and it also takes money, and we're trying to keep that content that we are producing for free, so it's necessary for us to also accept sponsors, and we hope that you're okay with that and you enjoy the show nonetheless. Now on to the episode.
Hello, Nasties. Welcome to The Persistence. This is the She Who Persisted podcast, and my name is Bethany. I'll be your amazing, delightful, passionately angry host for this episode. Today, I want to give you a small glimpse into my life. As I've mentioned in prior episodes, I was raised in a Christian family, went to a Christian high school, graduated from a Christian university, and I left Christianity well before I even earned that university diploma. It's no secret that I often speak ill of the church, which you guys have all heard before, but I want to clarify now and for the future that I hold little resentment towards Christians and much more towards this growing group of hypocritical people whose voices just yell loudest within the Christian community. I have a high amount of respect for people from any faith, as I often say to those who inquire about my lack of religious affiliation, if you have found a constructive, healthy way to live your life and a path that gives you a sense of purpose and peace, I'm all for that. And just as I don't try to convince people that God doesn't exist, I only ask in return that people respect me enough not to try to convince me that a God does exist. So there are a few things that I'd like to explicitly touch on before you begin listening to the discussion that we're going to share with you today. First, what you're about to hear is a portion of our recording from last week, which means that last week we gave you a little heads up that there's some crackling audio and some other things like that, which we couldn't remove from the episode. We're working on it, and as always, we're trying to make our podcast as great as possible for you. We wanted to ensure that our bi-negativity episode was as focused as possible, and my passionate plea for LGBT acceptance in the Christian community felt too important, but also like too much of a tangent, to keep in the episode. We decided to separate it so that we could make it a very pointed focus for our listeners. Second, you're probably wondering what my qualifications are that I feel give me any sort of authority to discuss scriptural interpretation and the like. No, I didn't go to seminary or extensively study theology. I'm a commoner, if you will. Someone who went through Sunday school as a child, took doctrine courses in high school, and went to a Christian liberal arts college where I was required to take several theology courses. Along with my regular church attendance in my early life, these educational sources gave me a foundational knowledge about our topic today. However, I recognize that I definitely don't have all of the answers, so much of what I discuss is also based on in-depth conversations that I've had with scholars who do have higher education degrees in theology and could discuss with me issues surrounding translation from the original Greek or Hebrew of the Bible, as well as independent research that I've gathered from scholarly sources. I also want to note that in instances where I discuss the KJV Bible being used in the 18th and 19th century, I by no means mean to say that it was created then, only that it would have been the Bible in heaviest circulation. In the late 19th century, a translation of this was released called the English Revised Version, but I chose to disregard this translation solely because it had not retained the prevalence of the KJV in our modern society. In fact, a Nielsen study in 2016 found that in modern use, the KJV comes second only to the New International Version, which was published in its entirety in 1978, and which is the second translation I cite in this episode, sometimes reading a verse from both versions so you can hear how translations vary, even within the same base language of English. Now, the disclaimer that I wish to offer before I launch into this episode is that I am by no means an expert on the ancient texts. However, I feel that I have garnered enough of an understanding of the core arguments against homosexuality, as well as a background in several versions of the Bible verses used to support this worldview, that I am willing to offer some form of authority with my words. You are free to disagree, and I won't take offense. But if you do disagree, we'd love to engage with you on our podcast discussion group on Facebook. Finally, I want to conclude by giving a shout-out to all of my LGBT friends in the church who have been willing to speak up, advocate, and fight for themselves, often in the face of an unimaginable lashback and trauma. I find you all truly amazing, and while I know that my thanks doesn't take back the years you've faced of having people tell you that you can't reject heteronormativity and still be a Christian, I want you to know that you are the people who have kept me away from total despair for the church, because in you, in your words and actions as marginalized and vilified group, have truly shown me what the love of Christ would look like if I believed that it existed. In the end, the most powerful tool that we have as humans is love, and I feel a great sadness that we don't exercise it more. So please, dear listeners, regardless of your religious beliefs or affiliations, regardless of race, gender, or any other form of identity you may choose to apply to yourself, please choose to employ love first and foremost. And now, without further ado, take a deep breath, grab all the chocolate you can, and prepare to hear me butcher every Greek word that I can manage.
She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
I'm gonna get scholarly here and say that so many people that I've interacted with who have negative reactions to non-binary genders and non-heteronormativity are people who haven't really read the Bible. They're people who, these Christians who have these issues, are people who maybe have grown up in a conservative church or went to Christian school or things like that. And what they're doing is what I call parroting. They're repeating exactly what they've heard their pastors or their parents or their friends say. And that generally it's not scripturally based research that they've done. And so, I've talked to so many scholars about the biblical text, because oftentimes there are like five or six Bible passages that are used to declare anything other than heterosexuality as sinful. So I don't know. Have you guys heard some of these arguments, some of these verses, like you shall not lie with man as you lie with woman, stuff like that?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say that I did not grow up in like a Christian household, or I don't have a religious background. So I've heard those things, but they don't really mean anything to me. So I'm aware that those Bible verses exist, but yeah. I didn't grow up in a culture where those things were said to me or where I learned those things or anything like that.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting, because as you look at, you know, the like very strong reactions that people have to homosexuality and bisexuality, even asexuality, pansexuality, all of these different things that are not heteronormative, in the United States, a lot of that comes from religious teaching. Yes. And it's meant to be a land of religious freedom. That's what it was based on. But what it comes down to right now in modern society is, well, the Bible says this, and so we're going to make our public policies based off of this. So I wanted to, if it's okay with you guys, I kind of want to dissect some of these verses, because there are two reasons why I want to do this. One, because I think there is a really strong point for educating yourself so that if someone comes to you and let's say they're bisexual or homosexual, you're not standing there going, I don't support your lifestyle because you're wrong, because the Bible says it, because what I'm about to tell you says that the Bible does not actually say that. But also because I think, you know, as someone who's bisexual, I needed to be able to refute their arguments. Yeah. And as someone who is an ally, so, you know, someone who maybe hasn't necessarily grown up in this toxic environment, if someone makes a comment that says, well, the Bible forbids it and you're all going to hell, you're able to recognize some of the passages that they're talking about and set them straight. So I don't know, this might be beneficial to some of our listeners.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think it's particularly interesting for American listeners.
Yes,
as you said, are very often confronted with very religion-based arguments. Yeah. I don't think it's that obvious in Europe. I mean, there are many people who are very homophobic or biphobic, but they usually, I think there's a religious undercurrent to those arguments in a lot of times, but it's not like an openly religious argument that they're making. So, but I think it's still a very interesting thing to know.
Yeah.
And I think a kind of underlying reason for talking about this is that because everything is so globally connected, we have the internet. And if you're a non-American listener who reads the news and stuff that comes out of the United States, or how the United States even interacts with other countries, then it's really, really important to kind of understand where some Americans are coming from with this volatile view of non-heteronormativity. So one of the first passages that always gets thrown around is Leviticus 18:22 and 20:13. And this talks about what I was just saying, that idea of you shall not lie with man as you lie with woman. So I want to just step back for a moment and talk about the context of this verse, because one of the things that really bugs me about Christians who make these arguments are that they generally don't understand the context of the Bible as a whole in the ancient Near East, but also they pull out, you know, one sentence from a whole chapter and they don't look at the context surrounding that sentence. So in the ancient Near East, much of the world was unexplored and unknown. So you have a lot of nomadic tribal communities, you have basic settlements that have built up into grander civilizations, things like that. The main objective in this time was procreation. Basically, people wanted to stake claim to as much land as possible once they settled down, because land meant power. The more land you had, the more of a force to be reckoned with you were considered. And a larger family meant a larger territorial army. So if you're a man and you're sleeping with another man, for example, you're not procreating. You're participating in something that will not continue your line, which is seen as like this gross misconduct, because your purpose in the world is to make sure that your community becomes as big as possible. But there's more to it than that. So these two verses right here in particular are actually speaking about prostitution. So in this time, men in particular were sleeping around and giving into lust with other women, with women other than their wives. And many of these men had multiple wives. So it kind of seemed a little bit silly to me that they'd want to sleep with people other than their wives. But as we all know, lust is a pretty driving force. And the idea around this particular rule in the Bible was that in order to get around the morality clause that comes with marriage, where you're not allowed to commit adultery with another woman, these men would sleep with other men instead, trying to exploit this loophole in the traditional law. People now use it to justify homosexuality as a sin. But let's just be honest. If people cared that much about these
Old Testament laws. They wouldn't wear mixed fabric. They wouldn't have sex with a woman on her period. They wouldn't even touch a woman on her period. And they wouldn't get divorced. I mean, all of these are things that are talked about in great depth. And most of them come out of Leviticus. So I feel like there's a lot of cherry picking in the faith of like, oh, I like what this says, but I don't like what this verse says. So I'm going to discard that, but I'm going to take this one, which I feel gives me power over other people.
The other thing that always kind of kills me is that in the New Testament, when Jesus says, like, this is a new covenant, yeah, and the only law that you have to follow is love one another as God loves you or as you yeah love God, like, that's the only fucking rule that anybody gives a shit about anymore.
Exactly.
Like, it's meant to go back to the Old Testament and focus on these, like, laws in the Old Testament, like, they've been superseded by this new one that's like, love everyone. So move on, people.
And that's the thing is that, you know, when you look at the Old Testament versus New Testament studies, in the Old Testament, you talk about having a God of vengeance. And in the New Testament, so, you know, punishment and things like that. But then in the New Testament, you have Jesus and you have a God of peace and a God of love and being kind to others, even if you don't support what they're doing and things like that. But you also go from the Old Testament of having, you know, shrines and sacrifices and things like that in very public view. You now have the New Testament where Jesus explicitly states, you know, don't be like the Pharisees who proclaim their faith in public but don't actually have faith, but be, you know, pray in private. And so I always see these things of like, people who want to publicly declare that they're a Christian, but then not follow the laws and the commandments that are set out for them in the New Testament, which is what makes them a Christian and what sets them apart from other religions like Judaism, which take the same basic story and strain, but have a different outcome, you know? So I think, you know, you start to see some of these punishments in the Old Testament start to get applied to the modern day. And, you know, one of these was in Romans chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. And it's interesting because, so this, in case you're not familiar, because this is one of the lesser arguments that is used. It says, for this cause, God gave them up unto vile affections, for even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature. And likewise, also the men, leaving the natural use of woman, burned into their lust one toward another, men with men working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was met. Now I'm just going to stop here for a second and say, if you're really confused by that verse, it's because I have taken the King James version of the Bible instead of the New International Version, which is more up to date. Precisely because I want to talk about some of the translation issues. So the King James Version, by the way, dates back to the 18th and 19th century. This is when you start to see more translations of the Bible, because the Bible was originally in Hebrew in the Old Testament, Greek in the New Testament, and then you have translations into, I think German is one of the first ones. And then from German into
the 500th anniversary of the translation, well, of the Reformation, and Martin Luther did the first translation into German.
Yeah. So then you have this really interesting point, which is that generally when these translations are being done, they're not necessarily being done from Hebrew and ancient Greek. They're being done from German or other languages to modernize them. And what happens when you modernize something is that sometimes you tend to lose the actual tone that's being taken. So in this particular passage, I think you have to look at the preceding verses in order to understand what's going on. So this passage is actually talking about how God punished his people for worshiping other gods and giving in to idolizing money and power above humility and charity, which are things that are really talked about in the New Testament of like valuable attributes that people should try to exhibit. So we see here that homosexuality is a curse in the sense that by not procreating, these people die out and become extinct, which is that the crux of most of these seeming curses throughout the Bible where homosexuality is involved. So here, homosexuality itself is not the sin, nor is it the punishment. Rather, it is the means through which God chooses to punish his people by not allowing them to further their ancestral line for turning away from him. Then, I mean, there are other verses. So you get into the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 11. Know ye that not that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God. Be not deceived, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, which is a word that you should keep in mind because I'm about to talk about it, nor abusers of themselves with mankind, nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor extortioners shall inherit the kingdom of God. And such were some of you, but ye are washed, but ye are sanctified, but ye are justified in the name of Lord Jesus and by the Spirit of our God. Now, this is a passage that was taught extensively at my Christian high school.
And it also tells us that hell is probably a really fun place.
I know, right?
Hell because is awesome.
I'm sitting here like, ooh, like, all of these people who get drunk get to go to hell. Awesome. Let's all drink together.
I'm coming.
Like, is there a permanent tap? This is great. Let's do it. You know, but I want to focus.
All my friends are there. So.
Yeah, exactly. I want to focus on one particular word here, which is effeminate. And this is why I've chosen to use the King James Version instead of the NIV of the Bible. Because once you get to the NIV, the translation that's used for the word effeminate generally gets changed to homosexual.
That is fascinating because they are not the same thing.
They are not at all. And so it's funny that the use of the word effeminate is mainly to condemn someone to hell. So for this, I went back to the original Greek because, like I said, let's be honest, most of the ideologies that we have incorporated today in our society didn't even exist in the ancient Near East.
Yes.
So there are two words in the ancient Greek that Paul, who is the writer of 1 Corinthians, uses to address the Corinthians, which is the group of people that he is writing to about some of the things that they've been doing, which are against what God has commanded them to do. So there are two words. There's malakoi, which means effeminate, and there's, I don't even know how to pronounce this because it is not a word that is used regularly, even in ancient Greek, which is arsenkotai. So malakoi means literally soft, and it's used to describe people who are weak and who have a lack of self-control. And while it was sometimes used to talk about sexual situations, it generally referred to giving into excessive lust, and so not fortifying yourself enough against temptation. And it wasn't until the 20th century that it was translated further to mean explicitly same-sex relationships. So I always found that interesting that, like, when you start going through and tracing back the translations, a lot of our modern words that we use to make the Bible, quote, more relatable, aren't actually following the spirit or the letter of what was being written in the ancient Greek.
At this point, I would like to refer to the scholar called David Halperin, who wrote a really interesting article about how male homosexuality is constructed in our culture and how other ideas of other cultures kind of were interwoven into that. I'm currently looking up the article. I'm going to tell you what it's actually called. I just have to Google it.
But we will definitely post the link and the information about it on the website.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's really interesting. It's about, it's about the history of male homosexuality. And he also talks about all of these terms in, like, Greece and so on and so forth, and talks about how these kind of feed into our idea nowadays of male homosexuality, and that idea of being effeminate and all of that also kind of comes into that. So it's really interesting. I'm going to post it on a blog page. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. No, that's great, because I think that a lot of times we don't know where some of our beliefs actually come from. And so that kind of leads into the second word, which is that arsenkotai, which is a combination of two words that actually some scholars think Paul made up, because it's incredibly rare and it's not really used anywhere other than his letter to the Corinthians. So I'm just going to break that word down really quickly to explain why this may have been mistranslated into our modern day language. So the first part of it is arson, which is male. Not like arson, like burning things, because that would be hilarious, but it's A-R-S-E-N. And then the second part of it is coitus, which means betters. So literally it means male betters. In the 20th century, this came to mean male-male sexual relationships. And although I'll admit that that's like a literal direct translation, we need to understand the spirit of the word, because like I said, pretty sure Paul made it up. And understand kind of what that would have meant. We need to go back and look at the cultural context of the passage. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is the study of pederasty, which was when an older man who's called an Erastes took a younger man who was called an Eromenos as an almost apprentice and taught him how to get on in society, giving him advantages that an elevated status would bring, because these older men were always very wealthy. But then these older men also would use the younger men to satisfy their own sexual desires. And so this was generally like older, wealthy men who took on a very young, attractive man. And it wasn't an explicit part of the relationship that they would have sex, but it was so often done that it was pretty much implied that if you became an Eromenos, you were meant to give the older man sexual pleasure. And it wasn't
common in classical cultures.
Yes. And if you like, I haven't studied all that much, just kind of basic, because I was really interested in these types of relationships, especially because you kind of see them in the origins of the Olympics, for example, where the younger men would have these wealthy male sponsors and they all race naked. This idea that these relationships, although oftentimes seen as voluntary, weren't. Because if you were a young man who hoped to get a leg up in that modern society, you had to have an Erastes mentor. And more than that, it was kind of non-consensual sexual experiences, because the young men couldn't say no if they hoped to keep their mentor. So this passage where he's using this phrase that he's made up here is actually talking about the exploitation and abuse of power in order to gain sexual favors, generally in that older male, younger male situation.
And it has nothing to do with our understanding of homosexuality or bisexuality today.
Right, exactly.
I think that's important. And it's also important, I think, to note that it was a completely different sexual culture.
Yes.
In which people understood themselves as sexual beings in very different ways than we do today. So I don't think it's even possible to describe that with terms that we have today.
Exactly.
And Beatrice, going back to David Halper and his book, 100 Years of Homosexuality.
Yeah, exactly. That's the book. That
book, talks about this issue of Greek love and how different of a concept it was from our, contemporary 19th, 20th century conception of homosexuality.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, it is worth noting that although many of the exchanges between the Erastes and Eromenos were non-consensual, there were a fair number of young men of Eromenos who did actually seek that in their mentored relationship, because the idea was that they would understand what sexual pleasure was. It was a way for a young man to learn from an older man that which the younger man didn't have the experience. So an older man has gone through life, has had sexual experience, knows what sexual pleasure is, and a young man is just coming into his adolescence and learning about his own body, and it was an exploration. So those relationships, which were consensual, were actually very beautiful, because it was about exploring your sexual identity and learning what you liked and what you didn't like. And then if you went on to be in a heterosexual relationship, you would know what brought you pleasure.
I mean, I think it's problematic to kind of, I think it's, as I said, it's problematic to talk about these relationships with our modern day terms or with our modern day sense of ethics and morality. Also because, as far as I know, there was in many like ancient cultures, there was this, there was a very like strong misogyny that was kind of, you know, the undercurrent of those relationships, also because oftentimes relationships with other men or with younger men or with boys were considered to be superior to relationships with women because male humans were considered superior to women.
No, and I'm certainly not saying that we should advocate for this to happen again.
I think
that, you know, it's good to remember that when we're doing all these translations from the Bible in particular, we really need to keep in mind that this is a completely different cultural context.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, a lot of times homosexual relationships in particular were about exploiting and abusing other people and finding power, whereas and now it's kind of transformed into finding love and compassion and support, and it's a very positive experience.
Yeah, and I think that maybe, you know, when we talk about how to address people who use the Bible as their justification for why we can't support homosexuality or bisexuality, that becomes the talking point, that this is, you know, the text, the part of the Bible that you're referring to, the cultural context for that is so different from the context that we are in right now in 21st century, you know, America, Europe, whatever, that we can't use their rules for what society is now. Right. And that, in fact, the way that we've been the way that we have been interpreting their rules is false. And we don't actually have a true understanding of what they were referring to.
And again, you have the cherry picking of, I want to follow this rule because it gives me power and elevates me above other people, but I don't want to follow this rule. I mean, one of the main things that always got to me is like divorce is mentioned over 40 times in the Bible and it's forbidden. I mean, once you're married to someone, that is a sacred covenant. And to break that is to break your covenant with God, where you have vowed in the eyes of God to be man and woman as one forever. And to break that means that you are violating the covenant. And so I always find it really interesting that although things like divorce are mentioned explicitly and the modern idea of homosexuality is mentioned implicitly, but not accurately, people choose to fight the battle over homosexuality instead of marriage, you know, instead of divorce and things like that.
Which kind of shows that people don't really get their ideas from the Bible
exactly
to begin with, but they have their ideas before they actually read that book. I mean, I don't believe in the Bible. I'm not a Christian, but, you know, they just take that book to kind of prove or support their own beliefs.
Yeah. And I, you know, I want to touch on one last passage to wrap this up, because it's one that I hear consistently. And for this, I'm going to read the King James Version and then the New International Version so that you can actually see and hear the difference between them. So this is from Genesis 19:5, and it's probably, besides the Leviticus verse, the most quoted one that I've heard. And again, Old Testament. So Christians, it was replaced by the New Testament and the New Covenant, but this still comes up more often than not, which is about Sodom and Gomorrah. So the brief backstory, two angels come to visit Lot, and the townspeople come and knock on Lot's door and demand that he produce the two angels. And then you get into the translation issues. So in the King James Version, it says, "And they called unto Lot, and they said unto him, Where are the men which came in to thee this night? Bring them out to us, that we may know them." Now, in the New International Version, this gets translated, and it says, "They called to Lot, Where are the men who came with you tonight? Bring them out to us, so that we can have sex with them." Now, I will concede that in the 19th century, to know someone, and, you know, you get this phrase, like, "I know them biblically," means to have sexual relations with them. However, In this context, the cities were called to display hospitality towards strangers. And here they are, banging down Lot's door and demanding that he bring out the two angels who have come to visit in order to know them. Now, sometimes this does translate to rape, and sometimes this translates to understanding their purpose for being in the town. But I think that, you know, for me, what I would consider to be more important than the fact that these men are coming and demanding either situation is that Lot then offers up his own daughters to the men that they may use them for whatever vile purpose they desire. So I think it's, you know, in the updated translations, it's kind of implied that these men from the town are coming to rape the newcomers, because then Lot says, well, I have two beautiful daughters and why don't you take them instead? Which is all kinds of disturbing. But I think we also need to remember that the citizens were actually defying this law to hospitality. And so people say, oh, Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed by God because of their sinfulness. It wasn't the sinfulness of homosexuality. It was the sinfulness of by being inhospitable. So, I think that's one of the things. And that, I think, is a concept that we can carry on. I mean, when we talk about being an ally, it's about being hospitable. It's about being kind and graceful and merciful and understanding someone else's life. Putting yourself in their shoes, but not thinking that if you were in their shoes, you could do something better, you know?
Bethany, I actually have a question for you, because
yes, please.
All of the Bible quotes that you just talked about that are, as you said, used as an argument kind of against same-sex relationships.
Yeah.
Those are true for bisexual people, for pansexual people, for homosexual people, for anybody who...
Anyone who doesn't fall into the heteronormative category. But that being said, that's also people who are in heterosexual relationships, but find vices outside of that as well.
So what I would be interested in is, did you come across, since this episode is specifically about bisexuality and binegativity, did you come across like any specific kind of discrimination or negativity concerning bisexuality from, you know, Christian people or in Christian communities that, you know, kind of sets it apart from good old homophobia, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so just speaking from my own experience again, I mean, I can't think of any verses specifically in the Bible, for example, that address bisexuality, because, again, I think like I said, a lot of the Bible verses and just the cultural context of the Bible are about procreation. And so...
I mean, homosexuality wasn't the concept either, so this is
right,
why...
Right, exactly. And so, you know, in modern times, we don't need to populate the world. Like, that's not something that our very existence is being threatened because people are not having heterosexual sex and producing offspring to further their line. I mean, that's just not a modern cultural concept that I think is a necessity to subscribe to. Then when you talk about the Christian faith in general and the modern Christian faith in particular, I mean, I had a really hard time even acknowledging that I had feelings towards a woman, because this kind of happened when I was in my undergraduate years, and I didn't really feel like I could tell anyone, because I knew that as soon as I confessed to having feelings for a woman, I was going to get arguments thrown at me for homosexuality. That, you know, I think a lot of times in Christian faith, people can't separate homophobia and binegativity. I mean, if you come out as being bisexual, I think oftentimes you just get lumped into gay or lesbian.
You
don't get to have your own identity. That's very harmful, because I think, you know, there are a lot of times where, like we were talking about before, there's support for people who are gay or lesbian, But if you're bisexual, people just think it's a phase and it's really hurtful because you can't talk about it with anyone. I mean, when I told my parents that I was bisexual, although they'll both kind of deny this now because they're very accepting people and they've grown quite a bit since I started, you know, putting loads of trials in their life by finding my own identity. You know, when I first came out, my father straight up ignored me for 2 weeks. Didn't talk to me, didn't say anything at all. I think in retrospect, it was because he was trying to process what I said. He probably also was busy. But as someone who was making an attempt to make a connection with her parents about her own identity, it was really quite hurtful because my father and I always had a close relationship. And then my mother said that I was just misinterpreting my feelings towards this woman. Yeah. And that actually, I probably really wanted to spend my life in a close friendship capacity with this woman, and that I wasn't actually sexually attracted to her, but I felt a strong sense of kinship connection.
Isn't that what they said about women who like didn't get married and only and had like who were lesbians and who spent time with these women and spent their entire lives with women? And
yeah,
like,
they're just good friends.
Close friends.
I mean, you look at it in modern society as well, when you've got, you know, all these posts about brides who are getting married and someone will say some stupid remark like, oh, look, best friends who are getting married on the same day. No, they're getting married to each other. Like, there are so many articles that I've seen where straight people just assume that two women can't be getting married to each other. Like, oh, this bridal shoot is obviously just two really good friends who are sharing their wedding day and the grooms just aren't pictured. No.
You know what? Nobody wants to share their fucking wedding day.
That's damn truth right there, you know? So I think that, you know, a lot of times there's this idea that if a woman has romantic or sexual feelings for another woman, it's just because you're misconstruing the passion of your friendship and the depth of your friendship.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think when you talk about bi erasure, that I think is one where you see bisexual women who are being erased into either lesbian or heterosexual who doesn't understand what a female friendship looks like, you know? Yeah, because then again, you have this idea of like, well, if two guys are really close and stuff, people generally don't assume that they're just friends. People generally assume, whether they're friends or not, that they're gay. Like, I have loads of guy friends who are very, very close to each other and maybe a little bit more touchy-feely than most guys are. And so people will just automatically assume they're gay rather than assume that they're just comfortable around each other, you know?
One thing that we also didn't touch upon, which is also, I think, very interesting when it comes to bi negativity, is that the kind of end all of, you know, sexual attraction seems to be being sexually attracted to a guy, because many bisexual men are, you know, misunderstood or kind of erased in that people think they are actually on their way to being gay. And many bisexual women are kind of not taken seriously as being actually straight. So the end goal seems to be the penis, apparently, which also kind of ties in with what I said about misogyny and bi negativity being really intertwined in our
society. But isn't that also a connection with, like, the ultimate goal is marriage and babies? So, like, you know, it has to be that you're either going to be with one person, you know, and marriage is only between two different people. So you can't be bisexual if you've chosen to be with either a woman or a man.
Yeah, and that if you are married to a man and you get divorced and you marry a woman, that actually you were just a closeted lesbian and you wanted to marry a man for an appearance or an image.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, I think there's also this idea that, you know, going back to like, oh, everything's about the penis, which is that a lot of people, men and women, believe that a woman cannot be satisfied except with a penis inserted into her vagina, which is just categorically untrue. But you hear so many men who, you know, and women as well, but men in particular, who are like, oh, it's just because, you know, like I said, you haven't found the right man, or you're bisexual because you're attracted to females, but you're not sexually satisfied. Men who think that women need to wear strap-ons to have sex because no other type of sex that doesn't involve a penis is going to be satisfactory.
Which is
whereas
also,
most women are sitting here like, I've never been satisfied by a penis. Like, it might be a nice penis.
Really, like, threatened if they realized how fantastic a Hitachi is. I mean,
exactly. Huh. Like, I honestly, I mean, I think so many men feel incredibly threatened when their partner even mentions having a vibrator, for example. Like, it's really sexy before you start dating, but once you're dating and start having sex, it's like, oh, do I not satisfy you enough? And it's like, okay, well, actually, I just really want a me time. And also, no, I'm sorry, your dick does not stimulate me in the same way that a vibrator that I control does.
Basic misunderstanding of female anatomy right here.
Well, and also female sexuality, because studies have shown that men believe that a woman orgasms from vaginal penetration all on its own, whereas scientific studies of female orgasms show that like 60% or more of women cannot have an orgasm from vaginal penetration. So sorry, guys, but if your woman is laying there making noises and says she's climaxed after like 40 minutes of really tiring sex, she probably was just tired and wanted it to be over. Like, most women say that they've faked an orgasm just because they're tired of having sex, because although it can be enjoyable, it generally doesn't lead to climax for a woman. So I think, again, this kind of leads to like basic understanding of human sexuality.
It's just so sad that people actually still believe those things, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't get it. I really don't get it.
Well, and I think it's because people tend to place their own sense of self-identity and self-importance over scientific research. Because if people actually were interested in those things, yeah, but I mean, as a woman, I've felt compelled to lie to a man before about having an orgasm.
Really?
Yeah, so in my last relationship,
like
I said, it was a really, really toxic relationship. But, like, he wouldn't leave me alone until I said that I'd had an orgasm. And so, like, 3 o'clock in the morning, he would wake me up to have sex, and I'd still be asleep.
God.
Yeah, it was a really bad relationship. But you get to this point where it's like, okay, I'm just going to tell him because that's what he wants to hear. And then he'll leave me alone, and I can go on to be my own person. Like, there's a sense of safety in acquiescing. And we see this in rape cases as well, where women say, well, I told him that I had an orgasm, you know, because I just wanted it to be over. I just wanted it to be done. Like, if you're in a domestic relationship and you feel a need to fake an orgasm, you should not be in that relationship. Because if you can't be open with your partner because you think that they'll get violent or they won't respect you or it'll hurt their feelings irreparably, it's not a healthy relationship. And that's something that took me a really long time to recognize, because as women in modern society, we're taught that we exist solely to please men.
So we said we were going to end this on a positive note.
Yes. Sorry.
Okay. Listen.
But this ties into being an ally, because to be totally honest, I want to throw it out there to everyone of any gender and any sexual identification. Like, if you are in a sexual relationship and you are not finding pleasure in it, you should not be in that relationship. If you are unable to talk to your sexual partner about your sexual pleasure, that is toxic and that is not going to help you in the long run. So as I can say, get out of there, honestly.
And if you know someone who's bisexual and you don't happen to be bisexual and you don't understand it, research it yourself. Don't expect the person who's bisexual to explain it to you. That's not their job.
And don't expect that just because they're bisexual, they're attracted to you. Bisexual does not mean that you're attracted to everyone. Bisexual means that you are attracted to certain people who happen to be of different genders.
And I think we could end the episode with a Bible quote again, which is, God said, Adam and Eve. There is an end here, so there's not an Adam or Eve. It's Adam and Eve, so do both, right?
Yeah.
No, sorry, that was a stupid joke, but you said you wanted to end on a positive note.
Well, I think it's one of these things where people are like, oh, it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. And you're like, well, that's because there were only two humans in existence on the planet. And I'm sorry, but unless you go with this whole, like, virginal birth thing, divine power by God, there is no way that two people could have procreated and furthered humanity without having heterosexual sex. And once we have other people in the world, no need for that, really.
You know? Also, Adam and Eve only had sons, right? So think about that.
Well, they would have had to have some daughters as well. And if
it's an allegory, it's not.
I mean, the thing is, though, that when you come right down to it, if you actually believe that everything in the Bible is completely 100% true and happened and is accurate, you're all related to each other, which means that no matter how you look at it, you're having sex with a family member. I mean, just gonna throw that out there because it's one of the things that always
happens.
That's how we can end it. You're all having sex with family members, so get over it.
Exactly, exactly. You can't judge someone based on what they do if you yourself are doing things that can be judged.
Completely.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the She Who Persisted podcast, and I hope you found it educational, enlightening, and inspiring. My hope is that all of our listeners, regardless of race, religion, or sexual identity and orientation, can take what they've heard here and utilize it out in the world, verbally combating those who would condemn our brothers and sisters to hell. Whether or not you believe in what the Bible says, we must acknowledge that our words, when they become violent and vindictive, when we use them to place ourselves in a position of power above others, and when we choose to attack those around us, cause serious damage, which, if left unchecked, can be permanent and fatal. We are all humans living on this earth, and we only get one shot at life. We need to make it count. One of my favorite phrases that my parents brought me up with is the idea that hurt people hurt people. Before you speak, I encourage you to think about whether you are speaking out of constructive love or out of hurt. The way you approach someone in conversation, in your tone and your attitude, can make a world of difference. Love your neighbors, love yourselves, love this world that we live in. Join together to make it the best that it can be, which means armoring up with the wisdom to know what to say and the discernment to know whether or not to say it. Educate yourselves. Be passionate. Be supportive. I understand that issues revolving around LGBT and pride can often be sensitive, especially in this episode, which brings to light so many open wounds that are not so easily bandaged and healed. As I wish to close out the podcast on a positive note, I want to make sure that all of our listeners are made aware of support available to you. This is one case where I may not advocate using Google, as we so often do, because when you look up Christian support groups that assist LGBT folks, many of the results that come back are homosexual healing facilities, which are meant to, quote, cure you and set you back on what they call God's intended path for your life. Let me firmly and decisively say now that you do not need curing. You don't need to be fixed, for you are not broken to begin with. You are still growing into your potential, no matter where you are in life. You are still becoming what you will be, to borrow a phrase from my doctrine class. Do not allow anyone to steal that light from your life and try to make you question who you have become or who you want to be. And if you're not sure of what that is yet, you're not alone. I want to conclude by pointing you to some positive, supportive resources. First, I've really enjoyed reading the information on the Christian Gay Network, which you can find online. They have a great online community, which you'll need to register for, but it's free and allows you some anonymity, as the content is no longer visible in Google searches, and it's a starting point for emotional and religious support. For our U.S. listeners in particular, I'd recommend checking out the Marin Foundation. That's M-A-R-I-N. Especially if you are a parent or family member of someone who identifies as anything other than heterosexual, as they have an excellent catalog of support groups for family members who want a non-threatening environment through which they can develop their understanding of the theology surrounding LGBT issues. Finally, for listeners worldwide, if you're a Christian or are interested in Christianity but want a safe space where you can go to attend church, I recommend that you search on gaychurch.org. U.S. listeners can search by postcode. Other countries can search by their country. This list is certainly not exhaustive, but it may be a starting point if you're interested. I do want to add that we at She Who Persisted have no religious affiliation, nor do we promote any certain religion. The point of this episode was to draw attention to some of the arguments which strong anti-LGBT Christians use to oppose and erase the LGBT community. We understand that there are people who are in the LGBT community and the Christian community, and we want to make sure that you know that you are not alone. Again, we encourage all of you to come discuss some of these issues or verses, or connect with other LGBT folks in your area or around the world on our Facebook discussion page. I personally would love to have a conversation with anyone about what we've discovered and discussed in this episode, as well as any other questions you may have regarding the church's treatment of LGBT issues. But for now, I bid you adieu with our traditional charge. Thank you, dear listeners, and stay nasty.